You know, if you're Jewish, you can only grow up to be one of three things, and I'm Jewish. Those are a doctor, a lawyer, or failure. And and a preacher definitely falls in category number three, if you understand what I'm saying.
That was Lon Solomon, senior pastor of McLean Bible Church. Join us now as he brings us his story of a changed life. And now, here's Lon.
Now, how did a nice Jewish boy like me end up doing what I do for a living? That's what I want to tell you all about today. And I hope that as we talk about this, that maybe some little piece of my life will connect with some piece of your life, and that God will use what we're going to talk about today to really make a difference in your life. I was born and raised in Portsmouth, Virginia. Both my parents were Jewish. We were conservative Jews. You know, there are three major branches of Judaism: Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. We were conservative Jews. My mom lit Sabbath candles every Sabbath. You know, if you saw the movie Fiddler on the Roof, you saw the mother in that movie do that. My mom did that. We would go to synagogue on Sundays. I would go to Sunday school at the synagogue. My father would usually go to the men's breakfast and men's fellowship that they had every Sunday at the synagogue. I went to Hebrew school twice a week when I was in elementary school and junior high school. 2 days a week after school, we would all go to the synagogue and go to Hebrew school. And I was bar mitzvahed at age 13, the way every good Jewish boy ought to be. But, you know, in terms of the real presence of God in our home, it really wasn't there. We didn't own a Bible. I'd never read a Bible. We didn't sit down and pray before meals. We never prayed at all in my home. We were run-of-the-mill, standard Jewish people who went through the things that you're supposed to go through as Jewish people. We went to high holiday services. We went to Yom Kippur. We had a Passover Seder at our home. But really, the presence of God himself was just simply not a reality in our life. I can remember as a little boy praying a few times. I can remember laying in bed as a little boy trying to talk to God. I can even remember a few prayers that I believe as a young child God answered for me. And I kind of grew up believing that God probably existed. I mean, I had a sense that God was out there somewhere, but I didn't know him. I didn't know anything about him. I had no connection with him at all. And this is how I grew up. Well, when I was 13, I was bar mitzvahed. And then immediately after that, I would help reading the Torah in the synagogue. Sometimes I would go over for daily services, which happened, and I would read the Torah a little bit because I was pretty good at that. And but when I got to high school, my whole relationship with the synagogue began to change. I got interested in other things, girls and partying and drinking. And let's face it, guys, the synagogue just didn't hold much of a candle compared to that stuff, you know. And so I began to trail off in terms of going to synagogue. And the real coup de grace came when I was about 16, maybe just approaching 17. I was involved in the acting group at high school, in the thespian troupe. And when we would practice plays, if you weren't particularly on stage and your lines weren't, you know, up, we would just sit and talk. And so I was sitting and talking one day with a girl that was also in the play, and she began asking me about whether or not I knew for sure I was going to go to heaven. She began asking me about my personal relationship with God. Well, I'd never even heard of a personal relationship with God, never really talked or thought much about heaven or hell, because you just don't talk about that in the synagogue. And she kind of shook me up a little bit. So the very next time I was at the synagogue, I asked the rabbi if I could talk to him, and I asked him a question. I said, "Rabbi, I need to know, do Jews go to heaven or hell?" And he went, "Excuse me?" And I went, "No, do Jews go to heaven or hell? I need to know this because I've got a girl at my school who keeps telling me that I'm going to hell." And he said, "No," he said, "here's what I need to tell you." He said, "All Jewish people go to heaven." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, hell," he said, "is a Gentile problem." I said, "That's wonderful." I said, "That's wonderful. But just so I can defend myself, explain to me why this is so I can tell this girl." He said, "Well, we are all Abraham's descendants. And as Abraham's descendants, we have a kind of a different arrangement with God than the rest of the world does." And I said, "You mean to tell me that I could do all kinds of stuff, you know, and I could lie and I could be nasty and I'm still going to heaven because I'm Abraham's descendant? And he said, yeah. And actually, you know, there is a passage that I ran into many years later while I was doing graduate work at Johns Hopkins University from the Mishnah, from the Jewish rabbinic writings, that actually says that very same thing. It's in the Tractate Sanhedrin, and it says that very thing, that except for a couple of real bums, every Jewish person's going to heaven. So I was like, wow, this is fabulous. And I thought to myself, you mean even if I never come to synagogue again, I'm still going to heaven? And the answer is yes. And so that was pretty much the end of my relationship with synagogue. Well, I took him seriously, you know. Anyway, I went off to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill as an 18-year-old young man, confident that I was going to heaven because I was Jewish, and that was pretty much the end of the story. But I went off to the University of North Carolina excited about being out from under my parents' roof, excited about having those constraints removed, and excited now about being able to do everything I'd always fantasized about doing. But, you know, when you're living at home, you can't pull it off, you know. So I joined a social fraternity when I got to Chapel Hill. And if you saw the movie Animal House, my fraternity made Animal House look like, you know, a Christian day school. I mean, you just cannot imagine what went on. And I began getting deeply involved in drinking and partying and women and gambling. We would gamble all night. We'd start playing cards around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd play all night long. Then we'd, you know, about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, go to bed. Wake up and, you know, eat some lunch, and about 3, 4 o'clock, start again. And this was life in the fraternity house. You say, well, what about classes? What classes? We weren't there for classes. We were there for fun. And all you had to do was take enough classes to stay out of the Vietnam War in those days, and everything was fine, and get a 2.0, and everything was copacetic. Well, I did a couple of years of that. But by the beginning of my junior year, all of that was starting to get old. I don't know if any of you guys have been down that road, but you know, a lot of things that start off like that, being exciting and very titillating, they wear out. And after a while, it's like getting drunk one more time, having one more woman. I mean, it's, you know, you just, it's just not all that exciting anymore. It's kind of been there, done that, got the t-shirt type of thing, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, no. So by the time I was beginning my junior year and all that started getting stale, I had begun, you know, to think a little more seriously about the issues of life. You know, where was I going and what was my life all about and what am I doing here? And you know, those questions were beginning to plague me, and I didn't have any answers for them. And so I ended up that summer up in the Borscht Belt, up in the Catskills Mountains. A couple friends of mine and I, we had hitchhiked up there, and we were looking for a job. And we finally found a job working in one of the restaurants, one of the resort hotels up there, working in the restaurant and serving people. And we made a lot of money that summer. But this was the summer of 1969. And although when I went up there, I'd never heard the word Woodstock and had no idea what the word Woodstock represented, the Woodstock Music Festival was happening not too very far from where we were working. And some friends of mine that I made up there who were from New York said, hey, we need to go to Woodstock. And I'm like, that's cool. What is it? And they explained to me it's this big music festival. And I was like, that's wonderful. So we all bought tickets. I may be one of the very few people in the world who actually bought a ticket to Woodstock. They did sell them, honestly. They expected 50,000 people, that was it, and they sold tickets. I wish I had kept it. I mean, it would be worth a lot today. I didn't. But I actually bought a ticket, and then 500,000 people showed up without tickets, and tickets, you know, just didn't matter. But I went to Woodstock, spent the entire weekend there, and as a part of this whole New York experience, began to get very deeply involved in drugs. I had dabbled with drugs in Chapel Hill before I had gone up to New York, but when I got up to New York, it was the first time I ever dropped LSD. I had some friends who said, you know, if you're looking for answers to questions about the universe, you need to take this stuff. This stuff will enlighten you. This stuff will expand your mind. This stuff will help put you in touch with real expanded consciousness. And I was like, that sounds cool. Let's do it. And so the first time I ever took LSD was up in New York that summer. And as I began taking LSD, we had done a lot of grass and we had smoked a lot of hash, but this was the first time I ever did psychedelics. I came back to North Carolina to Chapel Hill to start the next year of school, convinced that I had gotten into the pathway to expand my mind, into the pathway that would help me find answers to the universe, and I came back as a very strong advocate of drugs. As a matter of fact, about 50 or 60% of the people in my fraternity who have ended up using drugs, I was the one who initially talked them into it, initially encouraged them to do it, and the one who initially provided the drugs for them to get involved. I was an advocate of this. And we began doing drugs all the time. I mean, we would smoke dope many times a day. I grew hair out to my shoulders, a big old afro. See, my hair doesn't grow down, it grows out. And so I had this huge afro almost out to my shoulders, and I wore, you know, bell bottoms and tank top and motorcycle boots and love beads and really looked the part. And the nice thing about hair like that is I could hide joints behind my ears and pull my hair over them, and the police would never think to look behind my ears, I figure. And so a normal day in Chapel Hill would start off with 6 or 8 joints, 4 behind each ear. And as the day went on, we would smoke them. That was a normal day in Chapel Hill. We dropped LSD 3, 4, 5 times a week, sometimes more. You say, well, Lon, if you're taking LSD 3, 4, 5 times a week and smoking dope every day, how in the world did you ever maintain any presence in class? The answer is we didn't. We was much more fun to sit up in a tree and smoke dope than it was to go to class. And so we just didn't go. But that was life in Chapel Hill. And I'm not telling you this because I'm proud of those days and proud of my lifestyle. I'm telling you this because I want you to get a sense of who I was at age 21 when Jesus Christ reached down and grabbed a hold of my life. I was not some nice, run-of-the-mill, everyday person who just, you know, went about my business and suddenly I decided I wanted to get religious. That's not what happened here. I was living a lifestyle that was about as separated from Jesus Christ and Christianity as you could possibly imagine. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. All the time I was doing dope like this, I want to tell you, I actually thought that I was making spiritual progress. And I actually thought that spiritually I was moving towards a place where I was going to get all these answers to the universe that I cared about. And again, I'm telling you all that because I want you to understand where I was in 1970 when Jesus Christ began to make an impact on my life. Now, the real turning point in my life, as I look back, came in the very early spring of 1971. I was sitting on a wall in downtown Chapel Hill. There's a little wall right there, if you've ever been there, right on the edge of campus. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. My friend and I, a good friend and fraternity brother that I did a lot of dope with, he and I were sitting there tripped out on LSD. And we were talking, and I said to him as part of this conversation, I said, you know, David, I said, Something really is bothering me. I said, you know, here we are, we're doing all these drugs and we're the flower people, you know, we're the love children. But instead of getting better, instead of getting more loving and more caring and more kind, I feel like I'm getting worse. I feel like I'm getting not better, but I'm going in the other direction. And he turned to me and he said, and I don't know that, you know, he wasn't a Christian, and I don't know he had any sense of the impact he was about to make on my life. But he turned to me and he said, Lon, he said, maybe you're not getting worse. He said, maybe you're just getting more honest about what you've really been all the time. I was like, whoa, dude, that's heavy, man. And to him, it was a passing comment. To me, it was like a sledgehammer had hit my life. Because, you know, I had grown up believing my own PR. I had grown up believing I was a good person, a nice person, a kind person, a giving person, an unselfish person, and a person that was going to heaven. That's what my rabbi told me. And all of a sudden, I was faced with the fact that maybe I wasn't all of that. All of a sudden, I was confronted with the fact that maybe the truth is that that was all a bunch of PR that I had blown out, and that the real me was a very different person. And the more I thought about what he said to me, the more I began to realize that he was right. And as I began coming to grips with this, really taking a hard, honest look at myself, I want to tell you what I saw I didn't like. I didn't like what I saw. And all of a sudden, my perspective on myself totally began to change. Suddenly, I began to see myself as a person in need. Not a person that was fine and doing all right, but a person in deep and desperate need. Suddenly, I began to see myself as being selfish and self-centered and self-ingratiating, a person who was immoral, a person who was unethical, a person who was profane. And I had to finally admit to myself, you know, Lon, to see yourself any other way, you are kidding yourself, friend. You are deceiving yourself, and it's a big game. You are not the person you always projected that you were. This is what you really were, and it was not a pretty picture. Well, I began to realize as a result of this that I needed help. I needed some change. I needed someone or something that could change me from the inside out. And That was a major turning point in my life, because up to that point, I didn't really feel I needed any outside help. But now I did, and it began to grip me. Drugs began to become passé at that point in my life, because I realized I'd been doing them for years now. I realized they could not change me from the inside out, and I decided I needed religion. I needed God in some form or another. So the first form I got into was Eastern religions. I went down and bought all these books on Eastern religions. Taoism, which is spelled with a T, by the way. Taoism, I read a lot of that. Confucianism, read a lot of that. Got a lot of books on Zen Buddhism by Alan Watts and other writers, and read a lot of those books. And you know what was interesting about these Eastern religions? They sounded wonderful on paper, but I just couldn't make them work in real life. I mean, I would go out and read Zen Buddhism for the first 3 hours of the morning, sitting in the woods with my legs crossed, you know, under a tree. And then I would get up and say to my friend, hey, what's for lunch? And blow my whole Zen for the day. You understand what I'm saying? Zen's gone. And I couldn't make this work. I really tried. I mean, I wanted to cut my hair in a ponytail and go dance around on the street with the Hare Krishnas and do all this stuff. Except I hated their food. Have you ever eaten that food? It's awful. So, you know, I couldn't be a Hare Krishna because I knew I'd starve to death. I couldn't eat the food. So I gave up on being a Hare Krishna because of that. But I was trying to make the rest of this work, and I couldn't. So I decided, all right, you know, I'm not going to be an Eastern religion person. And I decided maybe what I need to do is I need to go back to Judaism. You know, that's kind of my ace in the hole. Maybe I need to go get deeply involved in Judaism, and maybe I can find in Orthodox Judaism the answers that I need for life. So there was a campus rabbi, and I went to visit the campus rabbi. I walked into his office with my hair and my bell bottoms and everything, and I plopped down in his chair, and I said to him, I said, Rabbi, yeah? I said, I think God wants me to be a rabbi. And he looked at me and he said, no, I don't think so. I said, but Rabbi, listen, I have some deep-seated needs in my life. I've got some questions I really need answers for. And I began sharing with him about the hunger of my heart, sharing with him about the needs that I had. And he, I mean, I don't even think he had a clue what I was talking about. He gave me a couple of books to read. I didn't want books. I wanted somebody to come up and sit down next to me and look me in the eyes and say, I know the answers to the questions you're asking. I know how you can get changed on the inside and not be the ugly person that you've realized you are. And I can help you. He didn't do that for me. I don't think he even had a clue how to do that. And I walked out of his office and said, man, that's nothing there for me. Now, that was pretty depressing, because Judaism, going back to Judaism, had kind of always been my one ace in the hole. You know, I figure if everything else fails, I'll go back to Judaism. Now I'd gone back, having tried everything else I can think of. Women, drinking, partying, drugs, Eastern religions, now Judaism. And I still have no answers as to how to change myself. And remember, guys, the issue for me at this point was not so much that I was concerned about going to hell. I still believe what the rabbi told me at that point, that I was going to heaven. That wasn't my issue. My issue was I couldn't find the resources I needed to live life. I couldn't find the answers I needed to make life make sense and make me into the kind of person I was proud to be. I couldn't find that. Those were my issues. Well, I would sit and talk to my fraternity brothers about these things. They thought I completely lost my mind. We would sit around and smoke dope, and then I would say to them, you know, guys, why are we here? And why did God? Why are we on the earth? And what's our purpose in life? And where are we going? And you know, and what's the meaning of life? And they would all go to me, oh, man, you know, you are bumming us out, man. You know, what is wrong with you, man? Why have you got to ask questions like this? Why don't you just be like a normal person, you know? Why don't you just graduate from college and get a job and get married and have kids and raise them up and be a grandfather and die like normal people? Why have you got to have answers to all these stupid questions? My friends began to think I'd flipped out, began to wonder whether I'd lost my mind. And you know what? I began to wonder whether maybe I'd lost my mind. I mean, you read about all these guys who go trip out on LSD and they never come back. And I thought, well, maybe I'm on one of these trips and I never came back. I mean, I didn't think that I'd never come back. But then who never comes back thinks that they never came back, you know? Does that make any sense? So I'm like, well, maybe I've never come back and I'm just don't know. Maybe I'm really in some psychiatric hospital and I'm going under shock therapy and I'm thinking I'm an orange and hiding under the bed or something, you know? Reality was really messed up for me in those days. I mean, that's where I really was. And I was so confused, I didn't even know where reality was anymore. And I began to plan suicide. I said, no, this is stupid. It's absolutely stupid for me to grow up and live that kind of life and go through all the heartache and the pain of living life if I don't even know what I'm doing here and I don't even know what my purpose in life is and I hate the person I am on the inside. This is stupid. Why don't I just go ahead and take my life? And I was really planning on it. But I procrastinated so many things that I was going to. I just hadn't gotten around to it. But I had every intent. I had every intent of doing this. And in the spring of 1971, all of that changed. One spring day in Chapel Hill, I was walking on the streets of Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill is only about two blocks. And I was walking down Chapel Hill, this nice warm spring day, very crowded day, with my dog. I had a German Shepherd, about an 80-pound German Shepherd, 85-pound German Shepherd named Noah. I don't know why I named him Noah, but I'd had him since he was a pup. And he got into a fight, a little dog fight, right in front of the weirdest man in the universe. Let me tell you about the weirdest man in the universe. The weirdest man in the universe was a man named Bob Eckhart. Bob Eckhart was a man in his 40s at the time who worked in Durham, about 8 miles away from Chapel Hill. But he would come to Chapel Hill every Saturday with his Econoline van, his white Econoline van. He had scripture verses written all over the side of his white Econoline van. He had two big megaphone speakers mounted on the roof of his van, connected up to a record player where he would play scratchy old 78 hymns and blast them down the street out of these two megaphones. He would stand out on the street corner of Chapel Hill handing out pamphlets about Jesus Christ, and he would do that along with his wife all day every Saturday. Now, he was not well received in Chapel Hill. People spit on him. People threw the tracts back at him. People cursed him out. People were incredibly nasty to this guy. But week after week after week that spring, I saw him down there. I avoided him. I didn't want to get near the man. This is like out of a circus or something. But anyway, that day, my dog got into a fight right in front of where he was standing. And I pulled my dog apart from the dog that he was mangling at the time. And this other guy helped, Bob Eckhart helped me a little bit. And so here I am now, eyeball to eyeball with the weirdest man in the world. What do you say to the weirdest man in the world? I mean, I didn't want to say something wrong. So I looked at him and I said, hi. And he went, hello. Well, now what do you say? So I said, gotta go. And he said, okay, see ya. And I went, okay. And off I went. The whole encounter could not have lasted 30 seconds. But I have to tell you, in those 30 seconds of being eyeball to eyeball, about 2 feet away from this man and looking in his eyes, I walked away and something inside of me said to me, Lon, this guy has what you're looking for. You say, how do you know that? Friends, I can't tell you how I knew it. I don't have any empirical evidence. I can't put it in a test tube what I was feeling, but I'm telling you, I walked away and something inside of me said, Lon, this guy's got what you're looking for. The peace, the contentment, the wholeness, the healthiness that you're looking for, He's got it.
You've been listening to So What with Pastor Lon Solomon. So What is a broadcast extension of McLean Bible Church in Northern Virginia. Check out our website, mcleanbible.org, for service times, directions to one of our campuses near you in Tysons, Arlington, Montgomery County, Prince William, or to watch live on our internet campus. You can also order or download a copy of today's message, all at mcleanbible.org. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week when Lon answers one of life's most important questions, so what?